Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. The Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way. 1-866-408-7669. We have a lot going on today, including the State of the Union address just a couple of days away. You got Monday as a working day, and then you have Tuesday where it's actually going to happen. You wonder about the antics that are going to take place. The president today will participate in a working breakfast with the governors. I think this is kind of cool. All the Republican governors will be there. A little bit of tension with Governor Stitt of Oklahoma. I don't know if he's going to show. I assume he would, but the president's called him out because he's called the president out. Not like Tom Massey, but he has. Also, the Governor's Association, the president originally said, I don't want Democrats coming. They said, I will invite Democrats, but I just don't want Governor of Maryland, Westmore, and I don't want Jared Polis of Colorado. So they're not coming. And then some other governors have said, if they're not coming, I'm not coming. Well, that's good. Don't show up. But you know who's going to be there? Shapiro and Beshear. Why? They want to be seen in the White House. And they're posturing. I don't think there's any doubt they're going to run. We're also talking about the chances of war in Iran. I think it's really good, but not until the Gerald R. Ford gets there and not until the president addresses, flat out addresses the nation and say, this is the stakes. This is what we've been through. This is the last 47 years. This is how many Americans they've already killed and maimed. And this is what happens if we don't. Michael Doran will be with us, a Hudson Institute senior fellow, director of the Center for Peace and Security in the Middle East. He's going to be with us shortly. He's as knowledgeable as anyone. And we're also going to be covering politics aplenty. We have AOC and J.D. Vance continue their somewhat sniping relationship. I think that's an unfair balance, but somehow people put them on the same threshold. With us right now in studio, getting set for 8 hours of broadcasting this weekend, Fox and Friends weekend co-host Rachel Campos Stuffy, fresh off 3 hours with me and Lawrence Jones. Have you changed? Has that 3 hours that we were together changed you at all? Emotionally, physically?
It doesn't matter what you do or how much time I spend with you. I still always love hanging out with you, Brian.
Really? Do you think Allison, do you think she means that?
100%.
All right, I do.
Absolutely. First off, fantastic job filling in for Jesse. I think it was Wednesday or Tuesday?
Yeah.
Wednesday?
I did Wednesday for Jesse, and I filled in for Laura on Monday.
On Monday. So on Wednesday, I saw you with Maria Conchita Gonzalez.
Not Conchita, Maria Corina.
Corina Gonzalez.
Conchita is my grandmother's name.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of Spanish people have the same names, right? I mean, I don't mean to stereotype, but it does seem, it's just like, what
order?
There's
a lot of names. So yeah. Maria Corina Machado.
Right. So she is the democratically elected leader who was unable. No,
well,
excuse
she
me,
was the,
her party won.
Her party was, yeah.
And that guy won.
She's the face of the party. Yeah. She's the face of the opposition.
So the question is, when are elections going to be in Venezuela?
Yeah.
And I think they sold like 50 million barrels of oil yesterday out of Venezuela.
Yeah.
And we basically split it 50-50.
Yeah.
So far, it's been pretty smooth since the capture of Maduro, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of lessons that have been learned when you take out a leader, you depose a leader. In this case, you arrest him because he's a narco-terrorist. You don't want to leave that vacuum. And you have these communists in charge. And make no mistake, Delcy Rodriguez, ideologically, is like more like Che Guevara than even Maduro, who was just, he was also a commie, educated in some ways or trained up in Cuba, but she and her brother, Delcy and her brother, who's also her right-hand person, are hardcore commies. Their father was a communist, and so they've decided to work with these people, the Trump administration, to work with these commies, just so that we don't have a power vacuum. But the question is, when will democratic elections happen?
What do you think? What's the most plausible?
I think everything should be done on what's beneficial for America. If I'm President Trump, I want to do it before my midterms. I think that an election would be great for the Hispanic vote here in the United States. There are a lot of Hispanics who will see this as a good sign for the hemisphere and for kicking out the Chinese and the commies.
Do they already
the
see
commies.
It that way, though?
They do, but look, and people are like, why, you know, how do the people in Venezuela feel right now? They've had 27 years of socialism. Mm-hmm. And so they're patient. They're trusting President Trump. They saw that you know, incredible, flawless operation. They see him, you know, working with Delcy, but that's not what they want. 90% of the voters voted for the opposition. And so they want democracy. They want an election. Notice how they're not on the streets protesting. Why do you think that's the case, Brian?
Do you think it's a fear?
Yeah, of course. Of course. There's still repression. There's still, a secret police that's running around. We've got control, but you can only do so much when, you know, you only have an embassy. And these people have been operating and repressing people for 27 years. They have they know how to do this. And now, look, she's a smart woman, this Delcy Rodriguez, very clever, very astute. She's working with the government. She saw what happened to Maduro. Some say she might have even helped to make him the scapegoat so she could stay in power. She has a taste for money. She wore a, like, $2,000 dress for her inauguration. Most commies get that taste. They talk all mm-hmm. like they're with the people, and then they get used to the money. So she's a communist with a taste for money. I think the best thing we could do is give her a few million, maybe even more than that, and send her on her way and have some elections.
Do you think she runs? Like, for example, in 6 months, if there's an election, do you think she runs?
Yeah. I don't know. I think she could possibly be bought off. Delcy Rodriguez, she could be bought off potentially and go and be a celebrated lefty, you know, in London or something. But she could run. And you know, if things get better in Venezuela, she might be able to make a case that she's the one. Now, I don't think she wins because nobody's going to forget what these people did to this country. It was the jewel of Latin America. Every other Latin American country, Brian, wanted to be Venezuela. That's how rich in resources and wealth they were. And they were a shining city on a hill for Latin America.
And Hugo Chavez ruined it all. And he mentored Maduro. And who mentored him? Fidel Castro.
That's right.
So Cuba... some Cuban leaders had a conversation with Marco Rubio 3 days ago.
Yeah.
At which time, the best example, and I'm sure this came up, do you want to be in a prison like Noriega and Maduro, or do you want to live like Aristide and have a chance, the Haitian leader, just to get out while you can? And maybe a soft landing. I mean, do you think at 80-something Raul Castro gets that and the current leader of Cuba?
I think these people want to hold on to power. The problem is that their entire economy was being held up by Venezuela and also secret shipments of oil and other resources from Mexico because that commie leader over there, Claudia Sheinbaum, was also helping them.
I understand it had been stopped.
Exactly. So now these, you know, as we've taken control of that, of the Caribbean and what's moving in and out, I think that Cuba is in an economic freefall right now. I mean, you're seeing week-long power outages. The American government, Marco Rubio, Donald Trump, they're really tightening the screws there. And as things get worse and worse, the options for these leaders become fewer. And so and listen, this isn't just foreign policy to Marco. This is personal for Marco.
Many people.
Make no mistake, he wants to be either Secretary of State or President when when Cuba finally collapses.
Do you think, I mean, this is, that could be another major puzzle piece, but it would be great without any military action. I don't think military is even on the table. You don't need it.
You may not.
But, yeah, but the only thing is, can Russia, I guess Russia had a few supply flights in there, but they are flat on their back these days.
But Maduro was feeling that lack of interest from Russia as well. And, you know, at the end of his days, I mean, Russia was just like, listen, you're on your own. You know, like we have enough problems. And as you said, they're having their own economic issues.
And then you have a situation where China and 90 miles off our coast has set up a listening post.
Yeah.
So that's got to stop. I mean, the ripple effects and positives, and what's worked out in Panama. Finally, those contracts are gone.
Yeah.
And the Panama president, who's, I think was the
contracts
first,
with the Chinese, the Belt
Chinese
and Road initiatives, they said, we're not signing them anymore. And that's because one of the very first things.
They were ignored.
Well, one of the very first things President Trump did was say, we want back the Panama Canal. We built this thing. We didn't build it for you to give to the Chinese, our enemy. No way. You're going to either work with us, you're going to work with the Chinese. And by the way, that message that was sent to Panama has been sent across the hemisphere. The Chinese are finding it harder and harder to do what they did to Africa, which is basically colonize it, which is what they were doing in the Western Hemisphere. They were basically paying off these corrupt leaders. It doesn't take a lot in Latin America. You pay them off. They get some, you know, generational wealth, and they're willing to sell out their resources and their countries to the Chinese. But the people were angry about it, and the people would rather deal with America than the Chinese, because the Chinese treat everybody they colonize really horribly. And so President Trump is kicking the Chinese out of the hemisphere. It's really an amazing thing that's happening.
The one olive branch went out to Uruguay, said, hey, why don't you come visit? Because no one was talking to Uruguay. But Argentinian, Milei has come out, and basically he is America first, but he was making deals with the Chinese
at first. You know, the only holdout.
They have rare earth.
The main holdout when the Chinese were at the peak of their power in Latin America, the holdout was Paraguay. They were the only ones who said no way. And the Argentines were with them for a while, but then their economic situation got such, and that's what the Chinese do. They come in and they see when you're in economic problems, and they go, we'll help you. And then what they do is they end up owning all your resources.
Yeah. Let's talk about Iran. The President of the United States yesterday, cut four.
We do have some work to do with Iran. They can't have a nuclear weapon. It's very simple. You can't have peace in the Middle East if they have a nuclear weapon. And they can't have a nuclear weapon. And they've been told that very strongly.
Right. Nuclear weapon. President also told the people of Iran, I got your back. Go ahead. And they killed between 15 and 30,000 of them. Ballistic missiles also, as well as terror financing. But they're only talking about in Oman a nuclear weapon. Your thoughts here.
So I thought that Operation Midnight Hammer was going to take out this nuclear threat. I thought that's what we did. I'm a little confused about why we're back into this. You and I sat on the couch. We talked a lot about it. I've never found a war that Brian Kilmeade isn't for yet. You were definitely
true.
For that. But we kind of had a little debate on the couch. I don't feel like the rationale between why we should be so aggressive right now is there. I don't think that there's any guarantee that these poor protesters are going to do any better. Maybe they will. Maybe this is the opportunity you say. But I also think what we're not talking, we got to talk about the midterms, because we got to talk about America first. And so how would a conflict with Iran, Brian, impact the midterms?
Well,
if it went well, maybe like Operation Midnight Hammer, something sort of bloodless and, you know, quick and done, maybe. But what if it's not? And that is a nightmare for Republicans having to defend that before midterm. And if you don't get that, Brian, what do you get? You lose the House and you get impeachment for Trump?
Yeah.
End of his agenda?
Well, you don't get impeachment when a military operation goes bad. You do, with George Bush, you get reelected. Pretty easily over John Kerry. And then in the midterms, After Afghanistan, the president actually won the midterms. We only had another
times
president.
Times have changed, though, Brian. People are like, no more stupid wars. But
there's nothing stupid about a country continuing to kill and capture your people for the last 47 years. And for the EFPs that went into, which is IEDs on steroids, they were all over Iraq to kill our guys specifically. And the assassination attempts on the assassination promises from Iran on our president that just came as yesterday they were chanting in their parliament, death to America. So does anyone think they're legitimately negotiating a nuclear deal? And I agree with you on this. Midnight Hammer set them back maybe permanently, because if they start rebuilding effectively, Israel's going to hit them again. I don't think there's any doubt about
it. So then why do we have to do this?
For example, Israel couldn't have done Midnight Hammer.
No. But now that we've done Midnight Hammer...
Well, I'll finish.
Why don't you let Israel take care of it?
Number one, saying there's no war I don't want to be involved in is...
I'm kidding but you know.
But that's what they say about Lindsey Graham. But what they're saying is we have some perpetual problems. Cuba's always been a perpetual problem, right? They're spreading the communism throughout Central and South America. That's why Bolivia flipped. That's why Venezuela flipped. That's why we've had these issues throughout the area. And then you have an outpost for China and Russia. But that's not something that on a daily basis since the 60s and early 70s that we're really focused on. But if you look at Iran since 1979, they have been the problems. They killed our guys directly in the Khobar Towers. They killed them through Hezbollah in 1983. Then they kill our guys again in the Iraq War, where you could honestly say the insurgency was fueled predominantly by Iran that entire time. And then you have a situation where they are fueling Hezbollah and Hamas directly with weapons and training. And even October 7th, there's video of the Iranians training Hamas for that actual operation. And immediately they were able to, some people say, well, that wasn't us. Well, there's very proof it's us. So now you have a situation where they're killing their own people. Obama did nothing. He said, hey, I want to make a deal. I'm not going to do anything. And then when they rose up again, Biden did nothing. For this president took out Soleimani before he could do another terrorist activity. And this president's going to deal with it directly. And I just hope he follows through.
But you brought up Cuba. And I think that the problem.
Do you want to hold that into the next?
Sure.
Okay. More on this in just a moment. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Couple of minutes, Rachel. First off, I want to make sure you get your plug in. Anybody who I should look for over the next 8 hours, Saturday and Sunday, 6 to 10 on Fox and Friends Weekend. You don't have to give specifics. Sometimes a mystery is
You know
best.
What? It's a mystery. It's a mystery even to me at this point. I have something to plug. If you have not seen the Fox Nation from Palace to Prison on Maduro, this is the documentary that Fox Nation did with me on the situation from, you know, the start of the Chavez regime all the way to the capture of Maduro. You should check it out because you'll start to really understand, you know, what happened there, why it's so important, and how it affects our country.
Last minute, Cuba.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, you brought up Iran. I do believe what happens in the Western Hemisphere is of much greater consequence to us. You know, Cuba was a way for China, and so was Venezuela. These were gateways for China into the hemisphere. They were setting up military and commercial things that were going to be used for military purposes. So that's why I think that the situation in Venezuela, I'm generally, as you know, much more of a pacifist. I really was impressed and loved what happened in Venezuela because I think it matters to America. It's our backyard.
Yeah, I think that he's paying attention to our backyard, but I almost think Cuba is going to be economic pressure.
Absolutely. This is going to be. It's an economic freefall. Just keep, if you're looking at the economy there, keep watching because over the next few weeks, things will only continue to get worse unless There's some sort of deal, as you talked about, being made up. Marco Rubio speaking through back channels.
And he could say, look, you're going to go to prison. You're not going to have a choice.
Yeah.
So, and that would be something. And there'd be a whole lot of, Cuba's going to be really happy in Miami, right?
Oh, my goodness.
Little Havana.
You have the fall of the communists in Cuba and an election in Venezuela. You've got the whole Hispanic vote.
Right. I will hear that. Rachel will listen to you from 6 to 10 and then 6 to 10 on Sunday. All right?
That's right. Thanks, Brian.
All live. You listen to Brian Kilmeade Show. Michael Doran next.
Show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So we are doing our job. I hope that those who are seeking war and want to drag the United States into an unnecessary and disastrous war once again, I hope they won't prevail and let us diplomats work with each other and find a diplomatic solution, which I believe is at our reach and can be achieved in a very short period of time.
Really? Okay. That is the foreign minister talking on MSNBC this morning. Michael Doran joins us now. Hudson Institute, senior fellow and director of the Center for Peace and Security in the Middle East. Michael, do you believe this foreign minister that we're going to rapidly get together a deal? They want on a fast pace to get a deal that we can get something done?
No, I don't believe him. He's working under very strict restrictions from the Supreme Leader. He cannot offer the United States a diplomatic solution to the nuclear question, let alone anything else that is anywhere near what the United States needs.
Here's what Morsi, he said, cut 11.
We had a very good talks a few days ago in Geneva, and we were able to discuss the questions related to our nuclear program and to the U.S. sanctions. And we agreed on a set of principles or guiding principles for our negotiation and how a deal can look like. And we then were asked to prepare a draft of a possible deal. So next time that we meet, we can, go into that draft, start negotiating about its language, and hopefully come to a conclusion.
So that's how he left off. He beat the U.S. to any type of public statement, kind of caught, I think, the U.S. by surprise by saying we had a lot of progress within 2 weeks. We have a framework. So I guess we go back to your original answer. He's just trying to delay, it seems.
Yes, and this is a normal tactic that the Iranians use. I was the senior director in the White House for Iran back in 2005 to 7 for the whole Middle East, and Iran was in my portfolio. And I used to say to my colleagues that if we behaved like them, we would go before the cameras and say, you know, we met with the Iranians and we proposed that they disarm all of their proxies around the Middle East. And we were very happy with what they said in response. And then watch all of the Iranians have to go to explain to everyone that that's not actually what happened. Witkoff met with them and they discussed a framework, but their position and our position are so far apart that they can't be bridged with these negotiations.
So, Michael, you write that this could we have the firepower. I think the Gerald R. Ford is going to be there in a couple of days, be in position to, I guess, in more of a position to protect Israel and be able to go offensive as well. So if we get the firepower in place and the missile defense the best it can be, and we decide to take action, the Wall Street Journal says the president's considering an initial small action, limited action, just to send a message. Do you think that might be a good move?
Look, I think that if we want this to resolve in a way that we get what every president has said since Clinton we have to have, then use of force is almost inevitable unless they buckle. They already know we're serious. We already used force in June to send this message. The president assumed after the bloody nose we gave the Iranians in June that this would make them more amenable to negotiations. I don't think enough another limited strike is going to convince them that we're serious.
So what? So if we go at them, what do you think we're going to be aiming at? What do we take out? Because what we want to do is we don't want to own the country. We don't want a land war. We want to give the we give the people that are riding the streets a chance to run their own lives to a degree. But that's a very ethnically challenging place, more than one would think. So what are the risks and what should the targets be?
I think the number one target has to be the Supreme Leader. Iran is an unusual country. It's a dictatorship, but yet there is an open public debate about where Iran should go and what should it do. And there's a clear alternative view among the Iranian elite about how Iran should approach the set of problems that it has. You know, the water shortages, electrical shortages, the collapse of its currency, the collapse of its economy. And the answer that the other element of the elite, other than the Supreme Leader, is putting forward is that they should cut a deal with the Americans and come toward the Americans and stop supporting terrorism all around the region. The Supreme Leader is adamantly opposed to that position. He is a dictator, and I don't think we're going to move forward as long as he and his family are in charge.
But isn't the IRGC and the Bashtis, aren't they the ones killing people in cold blood and shooting people in the hospital beds? Doesn't that show you that they believe what the Ayatollah believes?
They certainly believe that if the regime goes down, they're going to be slaughtered by their own people. I don't know how much the ideology of the Ayatollah has purchased on all of their hearts. Maybe some of them. Others are just they're part of this system, and there's no way once you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound. But I think that you can find even among those elements a range of views about how to work with the United States. Ultimately, if we want to really stabilize, if that country is not going to be really stable until the IRGC is destroyed, I guess that's the ultimate goal. But I'm trying to think about this the way President Trump is thinking about it, exactly the way you put it. We want to get what we need, the minimum that we need, which is no nuclear weapons and no ballistic missiles that threaten our bases and Israel. And we can't get that as long as the Ayatollah is in power.
So he's 86 years old. He doesn't look healthy, but is probably hiding in tunnels like he was last time. You write that, and I did not think about this, Iran, after we did Midnight Hammer, we asked for a ceasefire, not Iran. And the Qataris, you write, intermediaries to seek a cessation of hostilities, they say it was proof that Trump blinked. Now, I don't see it that way, but do you think the Iranians see it that way?
No, they absolutely see it that way. They absolutely see it that way. Part of it is just propaganda. You know,
yeah.
When you run a dictatorship like this, you can't show any weakness to the outside world because you fear your own people as well. But that is actually what happened. You remember the angry exchange by President Trump before the television cameras on the morning of the ceasefire, where he got angry at the Israelis and the Iranians, and he said, you know, he cursed at them and said they have to stop fighting. It was Donald Trump who imposed the ceasefire. The Iranians never accepted it, and never accepted it formally. And they're very proud of that, and they identify that as a sign that it was the Americans who buckled and not them.
Yeah. Meanwhile, they pulled off a devastating attack on their nuclear sites, and we were not hit. So I don't know how they spin that in their own minds. So what are the risks of going in militarily? We said, seeing that we're not going in halfway if we go in. So what are the risks, Michael?
Before I do that, can I just address what you said about their victory doctrine is not totally absurd. because they recognize that each one of these rounds of fighting with them is costly to the United States and Israel. And we went through 25% of our THAAD interceptors. These are the exo-atmospheric interceptors. This is America. Forget about the Israelis. In June alone, we went through 25% of our global stockpile, and it takes 5 years to replenish that 25%. So they and the Chinese are aware that this comes at a cost to us. Look at this major military buildup that President Trump has ordered. That's costly, and history has taught them that they can wait the United States out because they can create a bigger mess than the United States wants to deal with. So yes, we're more powerful militarily than them, but they have the ability to cause us a lot of heartburn.
So if the attack takes place, and knowing that they have almost no missile defense right now, knowing that the Israelis would be a partner in this and their intelligence is beyond even I could put into a movie, they knew where the generals were. I imagine they know where the politicians sleep. Do you sense that there'll be virtually a joint operation?
I do. I think it will have to be because the Iranians have made clear that if they're attacked by us, they will attack Israel. So we're together in this. The problem with the limited strike that the Wall Street Journal reported is that from the Iranian point of view, that looks like the beginning. It's hard if you're on the receiving end of a limited strike. It's hard to know whether that is really a limited strike or whether they're going after you, and they're going to hit back with everything that they've got. So we have to go into the war in order to protect our own forces with everything that we have in order to suppress all that they have. I think the most important thing is that President Trump just make his goals very, very clear. And when the minute the fighting begins, he make it clear that the fighting will not end until they publicly accept our goals.
That is great. And I think he's got to address the American people. And I think he knows that, too. And I wouldn't, of people that he can trust not to leak on Democrats, among Democrats, I imagine the Gang of Eight. So when you look at targets, the Revolutionary Guard might be one. The ballistic missile production plants might be another. Maybe finishing off the other nuclear sites could be another. Maybe emptying a few prisons. I said the Israelis blew open the door to that infamous prison over in Israel, over in Iran. Can you give us an idea how that would look?
Yes, I think all of the things that you said, but I would hope that they would target the Supreme Leader first and foremost, the Supreme Leader and his entire apparatus. That will, if we eliminate him, that will change the whole balance between the United States and Iran. Just like when the Israelis took out Nasrallah, before the fall of Assad, the taking out of Nasrallah was the single greatest shift in the balance of power toward the United States and Israel that we've seen since October 7th. And so I really think we have to think of decapitation as the most efficient way to get right what we need. If you're a dictator, we can see watching the politics of this country, they don't care about their own civilians. They are willing to wipe out tens of thousands, maybe even more, hundreds of thousands of civilians in order to stay in power. But they do care about their own hides. So we have to make it clear that the leaders of that country are going to be held accountable.
I know, but a manhunt for an 86-year-old who probably's got a deep bunker might be a tough objective. And I think you point out a good thing, Michael. They told us before, if you take out these religious leaders, it'll inflame the region. Nasrallah is buried in rubble, dead, and it didn't inflame the region. It helped Hezbollah go flat on its back. This is what I look at, and tell me if it's naive. If you look at the Middle East now and the progress they have made and suppressing the Al-Qaeda doctrine, the Wahhabi religion that was in Saudi Arabia, it seems like these countries are thinking economy first. And they're beginning to think with their dollars. Then you look at Syria And as complex as that leader is, he's been a partner for us and certainly not an enemy to Israel. And he's an enemy to Iran. That is unbelievably helpful. And then you see what Israel did to Hezbollah and Hamas. And you know that their armaments and their money come from primarily Iran, along with the Houthis. And it all goes back to this country who put a bounty on the head of our president, who made it clear, you know, and they chanted yesterday, death to America. So I know I'm in danger of being too simplistic, but it's almost like a planner's wart. If you pull this out, those tentacles will die.
If you're overly simplistic, then so am I. I see it exactly the way you just stated it. All of the things that President Trump wants in the region, disarmament of Hamas and rebuilding of Gaza, disarmament of Hezbollah in Lebanon, it all goes back to Iran, and it all goes back to the supreme leader and his doctrine of perpetual conflict with the West and with Israel.
Yeah, I guess we're going to see what happens. Michael, thanks so much. I really feel, before I go, I think something's got to happen within 2 weeks. I don't think the president would do something that would overwhelm the State of the Union address and on Tuesday, especially with the Gerald R. Ford not in place yet. But I'm wondering what you thought the timing would be.
I agree with you again. He gave a 10 or 15 day time limit to the Iranians. I think he'll probably let that clock tick down. The playwright, short story writer Chekhov said, "You don't put a gun on the table in scene one unless it's going to be used in scene three." You see this kind of buildup that President Trump has ordered. He's not going to turn around and send aircraft carriers back to East Asia or the Caribbean without getting something significant from the Iranians.
Absolutely. And if you want to pivot to China, you got to handle this problem first. Michael Doran, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. That was great. Back in a moment.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. Just a couple of minutes here. Just a reminder, I know it seems like a far away, and I used to say that about Valentine's Day when we had the big appearance in Fort Myers. Great to see everybody there. How about May 30th in Reno, Nevada, and July 11th in Evansville, Indiana? I'm going to be bringing history to life in a fun, interesting way. History, liberty, and laughs. So, and it's streamed on Fox Nation. Just go to BrianKilmeade.com and get tickets so I can meet you in person. Also, VIP opportunities so I get you before. Also, you got to check out our YouTube page. We got it up and running now. It's youtube.com/TheBrianKilmeadeShow. And I hope everyone can see. We'll see clips from this show and other stuff that I'm doing on the air and other original things just on YouTube. So we have our own page now, a place for you to go and weigh in and tell me what you think about it along the way. So we're going to take a look at all that today. We also know the President of the United States is having, I know news is going to emerge from this. He's having his National Governors Association meeting at the White House. Soon he's going to have a ballroom to put everybody in. It looks like it passed its first hurdle to get approved, even though he wrecked the East Wing before he actually got approval and has laid the foundation already, I understand. Now, in 5:30 today, the Organization of Iranian American Communities will hold a rally and then a candlelight vigil right outside the White House. Then Senator Sanders and his socialist will have a big town hall with Ro Khanna of Stanford, California. Now, it's interesting. He wants to run for president. He is a congressman. Interesting guy. But he has lost me when he went after the Epstein files. Not that it doesn't deserve to be investigated, but it's pure politics. He doesn't. He's saying, I care about the survivors. Don't think so. What I think is interesting is, I'm going to say he doesn't care, but where was he 4 years ago if he really cared? Where was he when Epstein was on trial in 2019 if he really cared? Where was he before that? Tom Massey, the same thing. But Ro Khanna's taken on Gavin Newsom and talked about fraud and corruption. That's what I find interesting about him.
Well, the holidays have come and gone once again, but if you've forgotten to get that special someone in your life a gift, well, Mint Mobile is extending their holiday offer of half off unlimited wireless. So here's the idea. You get it now. You call it an early present for next year. What do you have to lose? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Limited time 50% off regular price for new customers. Upfront payment required. $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12-month plan. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds may slow after 50 gigabytes per month when network is busy. See terms.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way. We have a lot on tap today, including David Ignatius from the Washington Post standing by. We'll go inside what's happening in the Middle East, the ramifications of action being taken place. Trey Gowdy at the bottom of the hour, former chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton have agreed to come in and testify about their role with the in Jeffrey Epstein's saga. And she knows directly what it's like to question Hillary Clinton. A lot more to talk about, too, including this legal decision that just came in. So the Supreme Court has ruled against the Trump administration on broad global tariff authority. It's a major setback to the administration's economic policy. You know, they've gotten billions of dollars from the tariffs. It's helped them negotiate these huge trade deals. There are tariffs out there right now on allies and enemies around the country, used as punishment, used to hedge, used as leverage. So this is not good news. It's a worst case scenario on a 6-3 decision against Trump. It looks as though Trump, I know, was nervous about this. There's no question the president was nervous about this. And this is a real blow. The U.S. has collected more than $130 billion in tariff revenue so far. That according to U.S. Customs and Border Protection statistics. So are they supposed to write checks back to people? Reconfigure trade? This is really big. In fact, Jonathan Turley's on right now talking about it. Dave Ignatius joins us now. Hey, Dave, welcome back to Brian Kilmeade Show. I appreciate you joining
us. Thank you, Brian. It's great to be with you.
I know this is not exactly your area, but international is. This is a big blow to the White House, right?
It is. It's figuring out how to unwind all the things that have been put in place over the last year, since April 2nd, Liberation Day, so-called, is going to be difficult, not impossible. I haven't obviously had a chance to read the details of the decision. This was a tough one in that the language in the Constitution itself about tariffs is pretty straightforward, and there was always going to be a problem. That's been clear from the beginning of this case. But as you say, the question of what next is complicated and important.
You know, it's so interesting with Obamacare, they knew if they made a decision, they also made a decision and figured out how to get rid of the mandate and land the plane. They took some time into it, some nuance into it. Here they didn't. It seems like they ruled pretty bluntly. I'm not sure how everyone voted. I'm trying to get that right now. So the issue of the administration, according to the AP, at issue is the administration's use of international Emergency Economic Powers Act, which gives the president broad direction to declare an economic emergency and puts new import taxes in place targeting U.S. trading partners, as well as separate levies aimed at China, Canada, and Mexico. So that all goes by the board. The president's authority is diminished, and we'll see what's going to happen. And when the 6-3 decision, we'll find out who voted for what. Meanwhile, let's talk about what's happening in the Middle East. The Gerald R. Ford is not in place. Would you say that we would ever take action, barring an emergency or attack first, unless that second aircraft carrier was ready?
I think it's unlikely, given that the forces are in transit. The element of surprise, as you know, is crucial in warfare. So, you know, waiting until every asset is in place can remove that. My sense is that President Trump still does think he might get a deal that he would be satisfied with. He said as much yesterday. Maybe we'll get a deal, maybe we won't. But, Brian, like you, I've been struck not simply by the movement of the Gerald R. Ford carrier task force, but by all the other assets that would be necessary for fighting a protracted conflict in the region, refueling tankers, EW, electronic warfare planes, the fighter jets and the fuel sustainment that you'd need to conduct something that doesn't last a day or two, but several weeks or even more. So they're getting ready for appropriately for a conflict that could last. That's a conflict none of us, you know, would welcome. We don't want to go to war unless we have to. But I do think the assets that are coming tell us that this is being planned very carefully.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't like to do goes half measures when it comes to the military. I think that's pretty clear. Yes. Look how long the buildup in around Venezuela was. They say they get deployed F-22, F-35s, and they say that they will. They are stealth to avoid the surface-to-air missiles. The EA-186 is jamming aircraft to disrupt Iran's missile launchers. The F-15E, the F-16s will intercept Iran's drones. They have other 13 other ships in the region. So in the big picture, David, I always think about you because you know since 79 that they have been a problem for seven different presidents. Iran. And they've basically been cavalier about attacking Americans, Khobar Towers, 1983, the role they played in Hezbollah, taking out our Marines. We know about, I think it's EFPs, which are IEDs on steroids during the Iraq War. They've taken out our drones during Trump's first term. Very expensive. So this is not a Trump problem. This has been an American problem.
I agree with that entirely, Brian. I was in the American Embassy in Beirut about a half hour before an enormous car bomb exploded in April of 1983 that killed dozens of Americans in the embassy. It preceded the bombing of the Marine barracks. That's really the moment in which this Iran-sponsored, because this was an Iranian operation, war of terror against the United States began. 1983, it's a long time ago, more than 40 years ago. So people should realize that we do all have a stake in that regime bending to accept the rules that are appropriate for every nation, including Iran. I think all of us, having watched Iraq and Afghanistan, are properly wary about jumping into wars that are endless and bog us down, wars to create modern Western democracies in places where that's not yet possible. So that's a caution for all of us. Again, these are things that are shared by Republicans and Democrats. Concern about Iran as a country that sponsors terrorism, concern about wars that, you know, cost us a lot and don't achieve what we hoped. So those are the things I'm sure President Trump and his advisors are trying to balance right now.
Yesterday, the Russian did some drills with Iranian forces. What do you think the message is they wanted to send?
So Iran doesn't have many friends. Russia is not a very reliable friend. There's been tension for decades between those two countries. But given Iranian supply of drones and drone technology to Russia for Ukraine, they seem to be offering a supportive role. I would think the last thing that the Russians would want now, when they are really struggling still in Ukraine, is to get involved in a war in the Persian Gulf where they'd be wildly overmatched. I mean, that would be crazy even for Vladimir Putin. So I tend to think this is a gesture of support more than an actual beginning of operational planning and cooperation.
So I guess they just send somewhat of a message. But what is your take? And I know we got bigger picture to talk about, but the UK decided not to let us use Diego Garcia. I didn't think ever I would see the UK hurting us in an operation where we clearly understand what Iran has been doing since 1979. And Stormer says, no, I think it's an illegal activity. It goes against international law, so you don't have access to our bases. Yeah. Really?
So I was surprised by that also. Britain is our ally in good times and bad. I just need to say this is one reason you need to be careful if you're a president about seeming to blow off allies. And some of the things that, that Trump did surrounding the Greenland threats of invasion, purchase, et cetera, really did upset Europeans. And in the end, you can pay a cost where people pull back from you and don't make the decisions that you'd expect and want from them. So I in the long run, I think the British stand with us. But this decision on Diego Garcia, I think the simple answer, Brian, is the president needs to make the case to the world and to the American people why we're thinking of going to war more clearly than he has. I think that that's essential, not just in terms of getting British support, but so the American people understand what we might be sacrificing our soldiers, airmen, sailors for. What's this about? And so I think the more he does that, the more likely he is to get support at home and abroad.
So it's amazing because people are outraged about what was happening in Gaza. We saw all the protests in New York City and everywhere, right? And you saw it around the country. You see it in London regularly. But you hear between 7 and 30,000 people slaughtered in cold blood for demonstrating in Iran. Yep. And I saw some demonstrations, but not nearly what we saw with the Palestinians. And it's not that the Palestinians are more liked than the Iranians. Why does that innocent people being slaughtered in Iran by, which in my words, an evil government that's so unpopular with the people, as opposed to Israel in response to October 7th, why do people care more about that?
I wish I knew. The one thing is that the Iranians were successful in turning the cameras off, shutting down the internet for a period of a few days when they did the really worst of the slaughter. There was almost no imagery, unlike Gaza, where we saw pictures of, you know, the little babies in their mother's arms and things that are heart-wrenching for everybody. I just have been talking, Brian, with some Iranian-American friends of mine who've been in touch finally with their relatives who are hearing what happened on the streets, not just of Tehran, but cities around Iran. And they're horrifying stories of troops opening up with machine guns against crowds of protesters. One particularly gruesome account by somebody who is involved in ophthalmology in Iran of the Iranians shooting people who'd been demonstrating with BB guns in the eyes. There was a wave of terrible eye injuries in some cities, just as reprisal, as intimidation. So I think if people know more of those kinds of details, they'll understand just how odious this regime is and its behavior. But again, I think that's part of the administration's job. They need to, the American people need to understand, why are we doing this? What's this for? What's the benefit and rationale for our country?
I hear you, and we've been through this before. I think most people have over the last 20 plus years. And even after attacked in Afghanistan, sometimes the president will come out and say, we shouldn't have been in Afghanistan. Of course we should be in Afghanistan. How did we not respond? I mean, stay a while.
After 9/11, how could you stay?
It's crazy. But you can't stay. I mean, we should have. If we got bin Laden, would we have left? And maybe we would have. Right away. But that's something I know you'll probably write about in a book someday. But let's talk about this. Before we move in, I just want to talk briefly about Russia and Ukraine. Do you think something's going to happen, Dave Ignatius, with all your years of experience, judging by what you see and knowing this president now?
So I credit the president and his team. I think Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, has brought a lot of discipline to the Ukraine negotiations that's helped. I think they are working on a compromise involving the Ukrainians giving up some territory that Zelensky's not yet ready to make. I hear more and more Ukrainians saying maybe this is the time to do a deal. I think within the Ukrainian team that's been negotiating on Zelensky's behalf, there are people who have been really trying to find a path for compromise. The new chief of staff, former head of military intelligence, General Budanov, is an example. See somebody that the administration team has been working well with. So the Ukrainians just have to decide whether there is a deal now that will allow Ukraine
you know, most of Ukraine to become part of Europe, as people have been dreaming since 2014, and are they willing to make some concessions to get it? And as we often say, they're the only ones who can make the decision. I admire their bravery, but there does come a time when there's a deal that sensible people should accept because it's in their country's interest. It's not for me to say whether this is that moment, but I know that's what the administration is trying to push for, is that a deal that they could accept. There have been a lot of deals they couldn't accept. Maybe there's a deal coming that they could accept.
I just wonder if the Russians ever hit that tipping point, too, because they can't replace the people that they're losing now for the first time. And there's talk about a draft.
Yeah, there's talk about. So your listeners need to think about the numbers. I mean, Russian casualties now approaching 1.3 million. People dead and wounded. Casualties, as the president has said, on the order sometimes many thousands a day. Sometimes, every square kilometer being fought over in a gruesome slaughter on the ground. The Ukrainians, contrary to what I think some in the administration expected, have held their ground. They didn't get swept away through the fall and this very cold winter. I was in Kyiv a month ago, and I'm telling you, they are suffering there, Brian. But they've held strong, a very admirable performance. They can't hold forever, The president's basic idea, let's find a way, a just way to end this war. I'm all for that basic idea.
I know. Dave, it's a fascinating time with all your experience. Things seem to be on hyperspeed these days. everything just seems to be sped up. But our problems are coming front and center. It's almost like we're bringing the infection out, and we're going to be forced to deal with it. And the president's got some big decisions to make. Yep. Dave Ignatius at The Washington Post, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian. Always enjoy talking to you.
Same here. Back in a moment.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
This might be a blessing in disguise because we just had GDP report numbers from last year that show the economy significantly slowed. If all the tariffs that President announced are immediately eliminated and he has to take about a year, if he really chooses to do it again, has to take about a year to impose these tariffs again, that might actually have a positive boost on the economy, which could have a very positive effect on President Trump and Republicans by the midterm elections.
And, of course, that was John Yoo weighing in, former judicial advisor to President Bush, about the Supreme Court ruling 6-3 against Donald Trump, saying that he did not have the authority to put in sweeping tariffs and work it into trade deals. Who wrote the majority decision? John Roberts, the Bush appointee chief justice. He says the president asserts the extraordinary power to unilaterally impose tariffs on unlimited, does not have the power to assert unlimited tariffs for duration and the scope in light of the breadth of history and constitutional context. So now, with the dissent of Alito, Thomas, and Kavanaugh, the president's got to scramble. I don't know what they're going to do. How do you unwind and give back this money?
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This is what some of us predicted. This was a case where the administration was at a disadvantage. IEEPA does not refer to tariffs. And tariffs are a big deal under the Constitution. It's a critical form of revenue that is left to Congress. And I thought that the administration did a terrific job in front of the Supreme Court. They could not have argued this case better, in my view. But you can't really escape that language. And right out of the bat, when that oral argument began, the Chief Justice John Roberts said, this is a tax. And you could almost hear the administration gulping because that's not what they wanted the justices to take from their argument.
Jonathan Turley doing some instant analysis on the news. It came out about a half hour ago that on a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court has struck down President Trump's sweeping use of emergency powers. And it's called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Trump invoked the law to justify those taxes. Remember on Liberation Day and on different countries for different reasons. One was fentanyl. The other was punishing for what they're doing with Russia. Well, it was a 1977 law, as I mentioned, and essentially John Robertson writing the opinion, the majority opinion, said that it doesn't work here. This is too much power to the executive, which makes you wonder, what are they going to do with $122 billion in tariff revenue? What about all the trade deals that have been cut, that we have set tariffs with both countries? Are they by the boards? Trey Gowdy, former chairman of the House Oversight and Government Committee, Reform Committee, host of Sunday Night in America with Trey Gowdy. We're going to get a preview. That is Sunday at 9, joins us now. Hey, Trey, what is your take on what just happened?
You know, I was actually in balance therapy for dizziness, and then I come out to a fractured Supreme Court opinion, which, by the way, is not a cure for vertigo if you read this opinion, which I'm about halfway through it. I got to be honest with you, Brian. I understand. If he were to be angry, I would understand it. He should not be surprised. This was foretold during oral argument. And the truth is, if we remove the names, if we remove Trump, if we remove the names, most people would celebrate this as a kind of a reestablishing of branch equilibrium. I mean, the legislative branch was listed first in the Constitution for a reason. And for them to abdicate something, this is the tax. I mean, you can call it a license, you can call it a duty, but Republicans have been bragging about how much revenue that it produced. If that's not a tax, what is it? There are two easy ways to fix this, Brian. Number one, the administration can go back and find other tariff vehicles, not this emergency act. Number two, the easiest thing, before the close of business on next Friday, Congress could ratify every one of these tariffs and we would not have a problem. Congress cannot abdicate its major responsibilities to another branch. That's how I read this opinion.
So, we just did a trade deal with India, framed it out, Japan, all done. The EU, I think they're hesitating on it, but let's say it's done, the framework's done. So, do they have to undo that? I mean, or is that a separate thing?
No, I mean, it depends. I mean, trade deals the chief executive can do, if tariffs are part of that, then you could make the argument, if they're not isolated. Like, there are plenty of examples in this opinion and historic examples of presidents making isolated use of their powers. I think John Roberts would tell you, if he was on the phone, we've never seen it this size and scope before. And it was used for more than just an emergency. It was used to level the trade playing field. That's a laudable goal. I mean, Trump ran on that as a laudable goal. It's just the legislative branch's job to do it, which is why every time I have a Ways and Means guest on my show, I ask them, have y'all put any thought into ratifying the president's tariffs? And the truth is, the margins are so small. I mean, you saw what happened with the Canadian tariffs. Republicans broke ranks and went to kind of undo the Canadian tariffs. This is why our framers never designed us to be quick, Brian. They designed us to be thorough and deliberative, but not quick.
Here's what the president said yesterday about tariffs. Cut 20.
And to think I have to be in the United States Supreme Court for many, many months waiting for a decision on tariffs. Without tariffs, this country would be in such trouble right now. Without tariffs, this country would be like your company was 2 years ago. What a difference it made. And you know who brought the cases against us? People that are China-oriented, people that have business in China that want to rip us off and keep ripping us off, and the tariffs had stopped us. And not only China, other countries too. People from other countries like Canada and others, they sue us. Canada has ripped us off for years. Not anymore, they're not. And I'm waiting for a decision from the Supreme Court.
And he got it, and it was 6-3. Does it surprise you that Roberts, Gorsuch, joined the others?
It does not. I think Roberts wanted to write the opinion, and you have to be in the majority to write it. I think what you just heard the president say, he should say during his State of the Union. The only difference, what Roberts and our framers would tell you, is the president should be imploring Congress to fix all of what he just listed, trade imbalances, countries ripping us off, all of that. Our framers would say, Mr. President, you may very well be right, which is why you need to motivate the legislative branch to get off its behind and do exactly what you laid out. But there is no clear delegation of that congressional constitutional authority to the chief executive.
So Kavanaugh just flashed on the screen. Maybe it's in the dissent. He said the U.S. is now required to pay back billions of dollars. This is going to be one of the messiest things you can imagine.
Messy may be an understatement. I think you and I would be fined by the FCC if we were to fully describe how problematic this is. However, I can tell you it can be fixed. The president has options. I've had this conversation with him. There are other vehicles under which you can impose tariffs, not this act, but there are other vehicles, and you have a majority in the House and the Senate. You can get these tariffs ratified by the close of business next Friday if Congress is motivated to do so. To me, it is not a question of whether tariffs are good or whether they work or whether there's a trade imbalance. Give him all of that. You say you are right on all of that. The question is, how do you fix it? And we live in a society, Brian, I consider you to be a constitutional expert, despite the fact you didn't have to go to law school. How you do something matters in this republic every bit as much as what you do. We become so outcome determinative. We say, well, we like that idea. It doesn't matter how we get there. Our framers say you need to both get there the right way and reach the right conclusion. And that's, to me, what this opinion says, is you just did not do it the way the Constitution requires.
I hear you. By the way, the market doesn't hate it. It's up 85 points. It's not running with it, but it doesn't hate it. I know people in the apparel business were hoping this would be struck down because we have no ability to make clothes here anymore, sadly, since the 1990s. And they were in Vietnam and Thailand and China, and they were looking at huge tariffs that would bankrupt a lot of them. So there are some elements of our economy that are celebrating this. Maybe that's why the market's reacting the way it is. But if you're the president of the United States, how can you count on Congress? Because what, they have a 3-vote margin in the House, if that, and you already have some defectors already. Tom Massey will vote against anything Trump wants. And in the Senate, you have a majority, but you don't have 60.
I would tell Republicans, think back to what Biden did with student loans. Something can be publicly popular and still what we call ultra-virus or outside your authority. So the president and conservatives always talk about the Constitution and the balance. Where is the legislative branch? There is really not an argument to be made. It is not the weakest of the three branches right now. That was never the intent of our framers. It was supposed to be the most powerful. I mean, look at the foreign policy actions. Look at the war powers, declarations of war. Congress is AWOL, Brian. They are AWOL. So, look, the president's got a tough job. Not only is he kind of a quasi-speaker of the House, he's also the chief executive, the commander-in-chief. If I were writing his State of the Union, I would say exactly what he just said and just say, for all you guys that love to talk about the Constitution, do your daggum job. We need these tariffs. You pass them. I mean, right now, everybody just looks to the president to do it. But that's what the Democrats do. When they couldn't get something through the House and the Senate, they would do it by executive fiat. And we didn't like it when they did it.
Yeah. I hear you. But if so, if they do what the president did, Biden did on student loans, that's essentially his executive order, right?
And it got struck down.
Yeah. So this
and it got struck down.
So we'll see where it goes. Trey, what do you think? Now I think it changes. But what do you think the State of the Union should consist of? I'm under the belief that the president should talk about gains, but also should talk about things that aren't down yet. Beef is not down yet. Certain dairy products aren't down yet. Talk about the fact that the housing is still pretty much stuck, has not unglued. Would you? Is there a danger in showing a vulnerability in a speech like that that everyone's watching?
No, I think, honestly, Brian, one of the reasons you've been so successful in life is you communicate empathy and sympathy to the audience. Even if you're not experiencing it yourself, the ability to say, I feel your pain, I'm aware of it, to this younger generation that's worrying about whether or not automation is going to cost you a job, you're saddled with debt, you think housing is a lost dream. I think the more leaders can say, I know what it is like to be in your shoes, with compassion and empathy and sympathy, that would be a tone that I would strike. I would certainly highlight the success, but I would say we're not going to rest until every part of the American family is feeling this recovery.
That's the line. I love that line. I love that line. And I would also include, what are their ideas? I mean, it's not like you have an alternative big, beautiful bill, the Democratic version. You have, let's raise taxes on the rich, I guess. Let's get more green energy out there. Let's build more electric cars. I mean, that's another message I think would resonate for Republicans, wouldn't you think?
Yes. Look at California. They are literally punishing success. How is that the American story, that success is something to be taxed and punished? Yes, you can do it. Our goal is for each of you to be successful. Their goal is to tax and dissuade you from wanting to be successful. They don't have ideas. They will benefit, I think. I mean, historically, they'll benefit because history says they will. But that's not, I mean, two presidents have defied that. He can defy it. Part of it are your ideas, but a big part, I think, Brian, is how we communicate our ideas and whether the audience thinks, the jury thinks that we get their pain, their angst. I mean, crime is a perfect example. You and I may live in an insulated world,
yeah,
but that does not keep us from understanding that people are worried about their public safety. You can do both. You can be safe and still understand why people feel like they're not.
And you could also say, on that note specifically, you could say crime is down in some cases 100-year low. That's also something to run on.
Yes. Yeah. Now, the economy dominates everything. I'd be careful. You know, the Supreme Court's going to be there. You and I both remember Obama criticizing the Supreme Court. They can't really fight back in the State of the Union. I would say, okay, I've read your opinion. I may respectfully disagree with it. Tariffs are still a good idea. The Supreme Court never said tariffs are a bad idea. They never said, look, President, what you're trying to accomplish is wrong. That's not their job. They just said the right vehicle was not used. I would put all those people that are clapping and standing, all those people that are dying to get his endorsement for reelection, I'd say do your dadgum job.
I hear you. Trey, who do you have on coming up on Sunday at 9 p.m.?
Boy, I think it just shifted, don't you? I think, yeah. I'm going to have Brian Kilmeade on to talk about con law if I can get him.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about tariffs. We're going to talk about Nancy Guthrie. We're going to try to end on a happy note talking about Jesus in the desert talking to the devil, and that leads to 40 days of introspection and reflection.
That's cool. I guess, yeah, my lineup just blew up too. So
yeah, but you have the most impactful monologue in the entire world. So
right.
It's not like you're not going to be fine no matter what.
No, they did a study, Trey. That wasn't my opinion. They did a study. They looked at every monologue in all languages, and they said mine's number one. It's not me bragging.
I could have saved them the study. I could have told them that. When I watch it, I find myself being moved.
Right. Thank you. I almost believed you for a second.
I am true. You're one of a kind.
Well, thank you very much, Trey. You're the best. 9 o'clock Sunday night, that's Eastern time, Sunday night in America. Repeat it again, and then I'll follow you at 10. Trey Gowdy, thanks so much.
God bless you, brother. Take care.
Back in a moment.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Where or when does the president believe he's been falsely called racist?
You're kidding, right? I will pull you a plethora of examples. I'm sure there's many people in this room and on network television across the country who have accused him of the same. In fact, I know that because I've seen it with my own eyes.
That's Ed O'Keefe. Is he serious? I mean, he fills in for Margaret Brennan on the Sunday shows. I mean, does he really surprised that there's people calling President Trump racist? Want an example? Cut 39. Cut 38.
The president of the United States is racist.
He is a thin-skinned racist.
He has been racist.
There has never been a president in American history who's been as so openly racist.
A racist in chief.
The president oftentimes resorts to very bigoted, xenophobic, Islamophobic, racist rhetoric.
Case in point. Case closed. So there you go. And it's just the name calling. The good news is I think the American people are over it. If you feel that way, you feel that way. But for the people who are moderates, they just know it's not even possible. And why is it that he got more Republican, as a Republican, he got more votes than Bush, Reagan, percentage-wise. More percentage in total. John McCain and Mitt Romney. You know, I'm pretty sure they called Mitt Romney racist, too. They might have something negative to say about John McCain on that. But every time you talk about capitalism, free markets, they say you're trying to isolate a working class people or minorities. No, just trying to make the playing field even for all to excel. And if help is needed, it should be given, but not should be expected. So it's a constant refrain, but the big news, of course, is the tariffs have been struck down. The president's tariffs have been struck down. Cue the chaos, because that's the only thing you could say. We'll talk about all that and more on One Nation Sunday night on the Fox News Channel, 10 p.m. Eastern Time.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Everyone, so glad you're here. Brian Kilmeade Show coming here from Midtown Manhattan. Heard around the country, around the world. I was at the Knicks game last night as they played Detroit. Two of the best teams in basketball. Detroit's a lot better. That's all I could tell you. John Schell is going to be with us, the former NYPD chief of department. He was there for 30 years. How does he feel about our 34-year-old mayor, socialist slash communist, deciding that we're going to have social workers clear up homeless encampments? Good luck with that. And number two, raise taxes and cut 5,000, cut back on the 5,000 officers he was going to hire, that Eric Adams was going to hire. They canceled it. The big news, of course, is by a 6-3 decision, the president's tariffs were found to be unconstitutional. With us right now to talk about that, a woman that's going to be hosting Fox News Sunday and is scrambling her rundown, I am sure, although she's a legal expert and anchor of Fox News Sunday, Fox News' chief legal analyst, Shannon Bream. Shannon, you know, a lot of people, like Trey Gowdy was just on with me, said if you heard the arguments, you can't be that surprised. Mm-mm. Were you?
No, not at all. I think that was exactly right. The government struggled during those arguments. They did a great job in executing what they had, but gosh, there was so much resistance from across the bench that they knew that they were going to have a tough time with this. And, you know, when I talked to folks within the administration after that, they tried to put on a good face, like, listen, we feel optimistic about this. But they also did have to acknowledge at some point that they were looking at their plan B. They have other tariffs they can levy. This was just a much easier, bigger, quicker way to do a big chunk at once. But 6-3, these justices say, can't be done. So they've got to go and execute that plan B, which will take a little bit more time, but they clearly have other options.
So Justice Kavanaugh, I guess in the dissent, I have not read it yet, but they took an excerpt from it where he said, if this is struck down, mm-hmm. which it is, they're going to have to hand back billions of dollars.
Yes. Yeah. And he noted that the court didn't say anything about that. He says refunds of billions of dollars would have significant consequences to the U.S. Treasury, but the court today says nothing about whether and if so how the government should go about returning the billions of dollars that it's collected from importers. And when this question came up during the oral arguments, Justice Barrett brought it up and said this looks like it could be a mess. Justice Alito raised questions about this. The attorney who was representing one of the groups of plaintiffs were just this group of little, you know, small businesses. He said, well, you know, really, my clients are here to get their money back. But he didn't talk about, you know, how this was going to play out for billions in other dollars that may have to feed backwards. And the court did not give any direction on that today.
How is that unlike the Obamacare situation? Something that's equally as complicated.
Right. And to me, it came back to that question of taxation, because remember that Chief Justice Roberts and, you know, the majority that came together in that ACA decision years ago said essentially this was a tax issue. And that's where he started out again today, saying, and it came up during the oral arguments, these tariffs, the president wanted to say it's not a tax, which would be solely left in the purview of Congress, that this was a negotiating tool. If it happened to generate revenue, that was incidental. But what they tried to argue, the court in this case clearly didn't buy. They saw this as something. They said, listen, the president himself has been out there talking about what a good revenue generator this was, these tariffs.
And that's hurt him. That hurt him.
You know, yeah, it did hurt him. Because
he wanted to say it's an emergency. He wanted to say this is an emergency. He had to say this is an emergency. I need to have the executive authority to be able to do it. And when the president comes out and said, but should that matter, what you say in the public forum as opposed to what you argue in front of the justices?
Well, I think it's hard for you to have your attorney stand there, your solicitor general, and say, like, okay, we know the president's been bragging about bringing in billions of dollars, but this isn't about bringing in billions of dollars. I mean, it was just a tough argument for him to make, and he did the best he could.
So how come it worked the first term? He had tariffs in the first term, got a better trade deal. Why did it work in the first term? It's because small businesses got together and sued?
Well, I think because he was using this particular statute this time, and there's nothing in this IEPA, this Emergency Powers Act, there's nothing in there that uses the word tariff. It doesn't ever specifically authorize the president. It says he can do things, embargoes and quotas and different things, but it doesn't say tariffs. And the justices who stuck together in the 6-3 ruling essentially said, you know, Congress has to delegate something that big, that sweeping, that intentional. If they're going to give away their powers, it would have to be more clearly done. And it wasn't. And so for a majority of the justices, that was the breaking point. Now, listen, Congress could do something. They could try to pass something to clean up and say, here's a modification to IEPA. We do agree that the president can do tariffs. But how do you move that in an election year? And in a way that you would need Democrats, especially on the Senate side, you'd have to have them, unless you try to do this as a reconciliation bill, as they did with the One Big Beautiful Bill. It's not an easy lift, but it gets you down to the 50-vote majority, or 51 vote, versus the 60 that you would need to move this in the Senate and that they don't have.
So they would have to quickly write a bill that allows the president to do the specific tariffs or tariffs in general, pass it through the House, then pass it with a simple majority on reconciliation through the Senate?
Yeah, it would have to be, if they're going to pass something to allow them to do these tariffs, they would have to be modifying or clarifying that particular federal statute, this IEPA statute, because he has plenty of other tariffs that he can do. It just will take more time. It will have to be more precision focused, and it's a lot more effort than these sweeping tariffs that he did under the emergency powers.
Very interesting. So the other big story is what's happening with Iran and the President of the United States. Are we going to be taking out the IRGC? Are we going to be going after the Ayatollah? Are we going to be blowing up just what's the rebuilding of their nuclear program? What is going to be the story there? And the President of the United States talked about Iran and the stakes yesterday. Cut one.
Well, we're going to make a deal, or we're going to get a deal one way or the other. We're either going to get a deal, or it's going to be unfortunate for them. I would think that would be enough time, 10, 15 days, pretty much maximum.
Here's Michael Waltz, cut five.
Time is not on Iran's side. Yes, there's our military buildup and capabilities, but there's the maximum pressure that President Trump put in place last year on their economy. It was the second national security policy memorandum he put in right after coming into office. Their currency is tanking. Their foreign currency reserves are tanking.
So they are a mess economically. No water in Tehran. The rial is almost worthless. It's their currency. And we saw the riots in the streets and the assassination in cold blood of up to 30,000 of their people. So do you hear the war drums right now?
I think the president wants them to know, as he demonstrated when they hit their nuclear program last year with the precision of the U.S. military, that he means it. You've seen and talked about all the assets that we've moved into that region. And the president took heat during those demonstrations for saying, like, hey, we've got your back, and then not immediately doing something. Well, if you're going to have a kinetic strike, you got to have the assets in the region. So there's been some delay there. But there was also talk that we had allies and partners in the region who were cautioning the president, saying this could spark a broader regional conflict, and we think you need to think twice about this. But, you know, we're told that the president has every option on the table, and there's consideration of a limited initial targeted strike. But that's just one of the many things that the president has at his fingertips. We've seen the sanctions. Russia and China have helped Iran. They all help each other under these sanctions, trying to evade them. So there's a limit to how successful they can be, although I think we all agree the people of the country are suffering.
There's no question, and that's why the nuclear program, negotiating the nuclear program, is relatively odd. We know it's been set back. We don't even know if they can rebuild it. We know they're probably going to like to rebuild it. But I always thought if they ever got close, the Israelis could take it out themselves. But there's an opportunity now to take out an enemy that's been our enemy for 47 years. And the president seems to be in the pattern, thinking about it, do it. Same thing with Operation Midnight Hammer. Same thing with Venezuela. Mm-hmm. Soleimani was something they discussed in the Situation Room and acted on. So the president has been hitting Syria ever since they killed two of our guys in our interpreter, has been pounding ISIS over in Syria. So he does take action, but he does it when he's ready.
Right. And what that means is the options have to be there for him. And we're told they are, that basically there could be a strike as early as this weekend if there's going to be one, that the movement of assets and personnel have been critical to that. So, you know, the Department of War has given him what he needs if he decides to go that route. You know, there are all kinds of things that are bubbling on Capitol Hill. But again, the sanctions seem to have limited impact when it comes to doing something really big like regime change. You also have to ask these questions about what comes next. And that has got to be part of the calculation from the White House, too. Are there things in order to fill that vacuum, which could be a very dangerous place if you did topple the Ayatollah and the mullahs?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Today, the president's going to have the governors over. It looks like Bashir and Shapiro are going to be there. And if Polis and Westmore aren't, and some others won't be coming. Do you know other Democrats that are not coming? And do you find it interesting that Bashir and Shapiro are queuing up books and appearances? Do you believe that they're both going to get in?
I don't know. I mean, you know, then we hear that Governor Moore is going to come, not going to come, is going to come. You know, I think that the president and some of these Democrat governors who were very much on the 2028 list, and in that conversation, it's good for them to have each other as a foil, you know, and so they like the dust up, I think, with the president, because it gives them headlines and gives them a bit of street cred within the Democrat base. So I don't know if it benefits them more not to show up and complain about it or to show up and look like they're actually going to be in the same room and maybe a little bit of kumbaya with the president.
Yeah, we'll see. So, Shannon, who's going to be on your show?
So we've got House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries with us exclusively this weekend to talk about, obviously, the big tariff development, but ahead of the president's State of the Union address. We're still in a partial government shutdown. Why do they oppose, you know, proof of citizenship for voting? We have a lot of things to talk about with him. And I'm sure we'll talk about the economy, too. We've got Republican Senator Jim Banks to talk with us about all these things. And we've also got Congressman Wesley Hunt. We've been featuring this Senate race out of Texas where, listen, if Republicans want to hold on to the Senate, they absolutely cannot lose Texas. But they've got a really, you know, messy primary down there. So we've talked with Cornyn. We've talked with Paxton. Hunt joins us this weekend. And we've invited Tallarico and Crockett, the Democrats, too. But so far, no word they're joining.
Right. You don't want to get in trouble with the FCC. Make sure you balance that out.
Exactly. We are fair and balanced. We issue the invites. We can only interview the people who actually decide to show up.
All right. There you go. By the way, we are talking about the big story. The tariffs have been struck down by the Supreme Court. The president's got a plan B. He didn't want to talk about it prior strategically, but let's see what he can do. One option that Shannon just brought up and Trey just brought up, Trey Gowdy, is you can go pass something through Congress and do it on a simple majority. See if that could happen. Shannon, thanks so much. I had to tap into you for all your legal knowledge. I hope you're not too exhausted.
I'm here for you. Tell me, is there a dance party on Sunday night?
Nothing to dance about because I was pro-tariff.
Do you book people, though, who have a dance background just in case?
Well, I always book the weather guy that can dance.
He's got some serious moves.
Oh, he's amazing.
All right, maybe you can give us a lesson. Have a good weekend.
You too. Back in a moment.
Bye.
Keeping you informed, engaged, and always a step ahead. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We want to work with Albany to raise personal income taxes by 2% on the 33,000 New Yorkers earning more than $1 million a year, and to raise corporate taxes on the most profitable corporations. And we know that for far too long, New Yorkers have given far more to the state than what we have received in return. It is time to end the drain. If we cannot follow this first path, we will be forced onto a much more damaging path of last resort, one where we have to use the only tools at the city's disposal, raising property taxes and raiding our reserves. If we cannot pursue the first path, the only option we have remaining is the second path.
He's just a clown. This mayor is so out of his depth, Mayor Mamdani. And I tell you this because this is the template. If this guy works, if he ends up getting 60% approval rating and the economy starts going good and crime stays down, you'll watch this overwhelm the Democratic Party, which will be bad for the country, good for the Republicans. But you're watching a guy who can't, he's already shown, cannot organize a plow for the snow. And then it gets frozen when the weather drops. So she wasn't able to act quickly. And then for some reason, they can't pick up garbage anymore. I don't understand what's going on. And now you have a situation where he decides not to hire 5,000 cops that were on deck and financed to go. And he came out and said, leave the homeless encampments, which even Barack Obama was saying are ruining Los Angeles. He's bringing it back to New York. Then he's having social workers clear out encampments after 20 people froze to death. And now he's talking about raising taxes on everybody that makes over $120,000. When he said, I'm only going to be taxing millionaires. By the way, millionaires, that you live okay in New York City. Now he's going to be freezing the rent. You know, everyone's nervous that is a landlord or a building owner because expenses are going up, especially on utilities. You freeze the rent. People got to walk away from these buildings. And if you walk away from those buildings, maybe his goal is to have the city buy him and leave everyone in drab, barely sustainable conditions, but with rent that might be more affordable. So I think that he is such a disaster. And I also think there's a subtle thing going on. I don't get much into the culture wars. That's just not my thing. But this guy's a Muslim mayor. Mayor Bloomberg was a Jewish mayor. But we have other mayors, de Blasio. I'm not sure what religion he was. But he never missed an opportunity. A mass for a slain officer. A mass on St. Patrick's Day. A mass on Christmas, on Easter. We have a brand new cardinal for 2.5 million Catholics in New York City, and he's the first mayor in over 100 years to say he has an air quote conflict and doesn't show up. Meanwhile, we're hearing, and I'm seeing on social media, I haven't heard it myself, so I'm within the era of AI. I'm a little hesitant, but I'll just tell you, the whole call to prayer on Times Square yesterday that basically shut down, that everyone was Muslims praying in the middle of the street. I don't want to hear a call to prayer three times a day. I don't care if you're praying to whatever God you're doing. This is commerce. We're going. I don't want roads shut down so you can pray. Not in America. I mean, there are places for these things. That means everything. You don't give communion out on down Broadway if you're a Catholic. And I don't want to get into a religious debate right now, but this is pretty bad. I don't think he commented. The other day, there was this Jewish student who was beat up because he was Jewish by three thugs in the subway. I don't know what this guy, I don't even know if he said anything. Where normally a mayor would show up and say, this has got to stop and make an appearance with the guy. But this is where we're looking at right now. You have a situation where in certain cities, crime is down 50% overall. And you have a 100-year low on homicides in the nation. And you got these hotspots like Minneapolis, sanctuary cities, and Chicago, where crime really hasn't dropped that much. And you have illegal immigrants running wild. But places like New Orleans, Memphis, Washington, D.C., where you have Democratic situations, but maybe a Republican governor that doesn't have sanctuary situations, some degree of cooperation, and you see a big difference. So the other thing they're having, too, is another socialist, the leader of the socialists, 36-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She is sparring with J.D. Vance. She says, I understand that Vice President Vance believes that shooting a young mother and three in the face and three times is unacceptable in America that he wants to live in, and I do not. And that is fundamental difference between the Vice President Vance and I. I do not believe that the American people should be assassinated in the street. Now, he's referring to the fact that J.D. Vance had showed up a couple of weeks ago or 3 weeks ago and into Minneapolis and said, let's bring everything down. And nobody wants to see anyone hurt, but you should stop attacking ICE agents, whether you're running over them with the car or kicking out their lights. And that's what prompted all the change. And that's what prompted the shutdown of DHS. But know what's emerging? A little rivalry between J.D. Vance and AOC. The only thing AOC does better than J.D. Vance is social media. But when she's on social media, she's not telling you her global perspective and what she changed. She's vilifying the rich, going after Donald Trump, and talking about things that social media influencers talk about. She isn't talking about legislation she's trying to pass, Codell's that she went on, reflections on how to revitalize inner cities, what she would do about illegal immigration. Know what she says? I'm worried about basically conservatives springing up in different capitals.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. There's a lot going on right now. We're also following the big stories that Trump dealt a huge tariff blow today as the Supreme Court rules that all the tariffs he put out there are illegal, and we might be forced to pay back billions. There's other things that can be done. We look forward to hearing from that. I'm sure they plan for something like this happening, but it looks like a 6-3 decision. They lost Gorsuch. They lost Roberts. They lost Amy Coney Barrett. And then, of course, every Democrat of justice always votes on the liberal causes. Almost none of them ever break. But John Roberts breaks a lot. As you know, the Obamacare is still in play because in many respects, he just did not want to get criticized and make the Supreme Court look so partisan. Well, they don't look so partisan today. And that's going to it's going to affect the economy right now. Believe it or not, the market doesn't mind it. It is up about 41 points. And we have not heard from the president yet, but he has his big governor meeting, but give governor luncheon today. So we'll see how that goes. With us right now is John Schell, the former NYPD chief of department. He spent decades with maybe the finest police force in the country. I think so. John, welcome back.
Hey, Brian, how you doing, buddy?
I know retirement is relatively fresh, but it wasn't too long ago when you guys were there when Eric Adams, the former mayor, says we're going to add 5,000 more cops. What would that have put you at? And what did Mayor Mamdani decide to do?
Well, the 5,000 would have kind of broke even, because what happens is you hire 5,000, but you lose 4,000. So the net gain 1,000 would have helped. It would have got us around 35,000 and change. But now if you're saying, okay, I'm not hiring the 5,000 that Eric put on the table, now the question becomes, is he going to hire anybody? Because like I said yesterday to you, they lost 300 in January. 4,000 have been eligible to retire as of January 1st. When you net that out, let's just say he doesn't hire anybody and you lose 4,000, you're down to 31. That's not sustainable. And public safety will take a massive fate. Look, I ran the operations of this city 24/7, 365, and what it takes to keep this city safe, whether it be down in transit, protests, day-to-day movement of 8.5 million New Yorkers, a million visitors. It's not easy to maintain this city. It doesn't sleep. So to even think of going down a couple thousand cops, it's not sustainable. And I hope he's just posturing to get what he wants ultimately when that budget comes to the city council.
What about
Julie Menon? Yeah, the councils are going to be a stopgap, but I have no faith in those people. They have Democratic socialists anyway.
So you have a situation where he came out and said, I want the homeless encampments to stay. And then we have 19 die of hypothermia. And now he says, yeah, I'm going to look to move up, evidently, slowly. It leaks out that he's going to tell people to pick up the encampments, but he doesn't want the NYPD to do it. He wants social services to do it. Hey, John Schell, is that dangerous?
Listen, when you're talking homeless, you're also saying they're also mentally ill. They kind of go hand in hand. It's always dangerous. You know, a lot of the 911 calls that receive for, we'll just go to like the mostly disturbed people. A lot of them come over, when I say come over 911 as not violent. But these are people who aren't mentally stable and they could turn on a dime on you. How are they going to protect themselves?
Why they get into social work? To go into knife-wielding assailants? He says he wants emergency services to go in there, not cops, with what happened the other day with that deranged person running at the cops with a knife. And they said they should not have shot him.
I don't even know what to start with. Look, Brian, the only public safety issue he repeated himself constantly with October and November was, what you're talking about, mentally ill people and having social providers show up. And the NYPD responds to about 7 million calls for service. Only about 170,000 relate to emotionally disturbed people, right? 170,000. And only 1%. 1% of the 170,000 result in force being used, having to be used. And another 0.5% becomes deadly physical force. So that means 99% of the time, the NYPD gets it right in their response. 99%, that's pretty good batting average last time I checked, right? So why do you have to spend $8 million when we're $5 billion in the hole for this new public safety, community safety team? This is just appeasing his base with no factual merit tied to it. And then to your point, Brian, you're going to send these social workers at 1 o'clock in the morning, whether it be a homeless encampment with a mostly disturbed person or someone's home, and say, hi, we're here to help. And that person sees you, gets triggered by whatever uniform you're wearing, and comes at you with a big knife. What are you going to do? Call a timeout? It doesn't work that way. I mean, you got to call this out for what it is. It's just progressive lefts thinking they know better how to handle situations. Because feeling bad for people does not mean you have to be weak in your approach. Feeling bad for them doesn't help them. They need professional interdiction and professional help.
Yeah, and by the way, do you think these social services are, you hear about a guy with a knife, big guy with a knife in Staten Island, and then you get the call, can you go out there? Really? I didn't go to the academy. You know, I didn't train. I can't disarm this guy. What am I going to go out there and go, listen, I know things are tough, put down the knife. And when that doesn't work, like when the cops told him to do that, now this mayor went and visited the attacker in the hospital.
You know, one of his many word salad mantras was one New York, right? All New Yorkers, whatever the heck it is. All right. You want to go visit a family as a mayor, as on behalf of the whole city? I don't have too much of an issue with that, too much. But you better go visit the cops who are traumatized by having. That's not a normal event for a cop to go through, number one. Number two, unless he did it privately, I didn't see him visiting the cops. I'll tell you what, Brian, Eric Adams constantly would get me on the phone, say, hey, call these two cops, put me on speakerphone or whatever. And he would, in situations like this, he would call them up quietly. He never advertised it. He would call them up privately, and he would give them words of encouragement.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between a mayor, Eric, a crime-fighting mayor, if you will, and Mayor Mamdani.
So now he's raising taxes, even though utilities are up for landlords, 29%, maintenance 33%, administrative costs are up 20%, and insurance costs are up 115%. And now this 34-year-old with no experience except he worked a summer camp is going to tell everyone, freeze the rents. Let me ask you something, Commissioner. It's not really your area, but you understand this. If I'm running a building and now I can't raise rent, and then you're going to go fine me because there are certain leaks here and there's plumbing that's got to be done and painting that's got to take place, and you're going to blame me for letting a building go into disrepair when I can't even raise the rent while my costs are this high because of the taxes you helped put in?
Well, let me compare to something. I'm a retired civil servant worker right now. I have a pension. Okay, I also just started my own. I'm a small business owner right now. Look at Florida. I don't know if you saw what happened yesterday in Florida. The House in Florida voted 80-20 to eliminate property tax.
Really?
All right, 80-20 in the House. You know it's going to pass in the Senate. So that whole scenario you just painted for, say, a small business owner in New York City, they have no state tax, no local tax. Now you don't have to pay, you're not going to have to pay property tax. It's going to pass in the Senate. And their budget is smaller than or bigger than New York City with much more people.
Yeah, you got a whole state budget, which is less than New York City budget.
Exactly. So take that whole what I just said and compare it to what you said. Why would a small business owner like myself stay here? What's my incentive?
Because you want because you want to walk on snow that's been there for 3 weeks, or to
step over I want to walk on black garbage? Snow. Run through an encampment, and if I need help, I'll call the Department of Public Safety, whatever agency he's creating, and get some. It's, you know, I hate to laugh about it, but I just don't see a point of return at that point when we can't return, if that makes sense.
Well, also, and your taxes on your pension, aren't they less?
Well, my pension here is just federally taxed, thank God. But my property tax, where I live, 10%, I'll be paying over $20,000 a year in property tax if this 10% goes through.
So he also decided to weigh in on transgender surgeries. NYU Langone, Ken Langone, he's the one who financed this whole thing, says we're not going to do transgender surgeries on teens. I think this is the most humane thing possible. It's like saying, I'm not going to let teens drink. Whatever your situation is, whatever mental torture you're going through, can you wait till 18 before you disconfigure your body? It seems logical. Massachusetts just did it, the University of Massachusetts. Mondami hears about this, and he slams the New York City hospital for ending transgender care. He said, another example of a private institution capitulating to the federal government's assault on transgender rights. In the face of these attacks, New York City will continue to be a refuge for LGBTQA+ community. So that's your guy.
Yeah, they call this an 80-20 issue. I call it a 90-10 issue. I make it real simple. When you're an adult, 18, 21, whatever number you want to put on it, then do what you deem appropriate. But until that time, if you're not an adult, you can't do that.
Understood.
It's real simple for me.
Yeah, it is. And it's just amazing. Visiting the attacker, going to bat for teens' transgender surgeries, and not showing up when the changing of the guard, if that's the right term, it probably isn't, as St. Patrick's, when Cardinal Dolan steps down, and Cardinal Hicks steps in, or I think Archbishop Hicks steps in. First time in about 100 years the mayor doesn't show up. Why is that?
I think it's just signaling what you stand for. These are little passive-aggressive maneuvers to your base of what you stand for. And unfortunately, what are we, 50 days into this? 50 days. Huh. Picture a conversation this time next year.
Right.
And the weather hasn't gotten warm yet. It's been brutally cold here, so people kind of hunkered down. Wait until this train starts really moving down the tracks.
And what we're trying to say is, too, John, you know this. When you're a mayor, there's very little Republican and Democrat. You know, when you're governor, absolutely. And when you're president, senator, absolutely. Everything's red and blue. But when you're mayor, you got to just get things going. You got to solve problems. You got to do hard work away from the cameras. My sense is, not only is he a lack of experience, he has a lack of interest in working out things and trying to figure things out.
I don't think he knows how to figure it out. Look at the team he built. These are all de Blasio retreads. These aren't new, exciting
people. The worst mayor in American history. Go ahead.
He brought in all the old people. So what result you think he can get? And look, the election, the TikTok videos, the word salad videos, they sounded great. And the generation bought it. You know, the young kids who want the Central Park view they went to college for the habits of melting ice caps and thought they were going to get a job with $250,000 a year. No, it didn't happen. The free stuff is out the window. Governor Hochul, you know, it's funny. Governor Hochul says, okay, I'm going to support you, politics as they are. I'm going to give you a quick win on child care. No problem. Quick win. Then I'm going to turn around. You said the budget was $12 billion. Then miraculously, it came down to $7 billion. I found $5 billion in drawer. I'm sorry. That was just a political ploy to the public. And then the governor turns around and says, I'll give you another $1.5 billion to bring you down to the five area. I tell you what, a simple thank you would have been nice. But now you try to blackmail or pigeonhole her into raising property tax, right? I'm sorry, raising the tax on millionaires. Or if you don't, then I'm going to have to go 10% on the elderly couple who lives in Queens, who's on a fixed income, bought the house, owns a house, and now they're scared to death. And if you're using that as a ploy to get to the final, budging of this of the city, man, shame on you for doing that. Because if you're an elderly couple, you're like, oh my God, honey, how are we going to pay 10% on we live on a fixed income? That is shameful.
It is.
Shameful, shameful, shameful.
That's who they elected. Former NYPD Chief of Department, John Schell. Thanks so much. I'll talk to you again, John. Thank you.
All right, Brian, good to be, brother.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. Back in a moment.
Real talk, real guests, real insight. Where curiosity meets conversation. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Are aliens real?
They're real, but I haven't seen them, and they're not being kept in,
Area 51.
Area 51. There's no underground facility. Unless there's this enormous conspiracy, and they hid it from the President of the United States.
Well, he gave classified information. He's not supposed to be doing that.
You know? So aliens are real?
Well, I don't know if they're real or not. I can tell you he gave classified information. He's not supposed to be doing that. He made a big mistake. He took it out of classified information. No, I don't have an opinion on it. I never talk about it. A lot of people do. A lot of people believe it.
And then after that, everybody was talking about aliens. We even discussed it this morning. And the President of the United States got a pretty good source, might even put it in the State of the Union address. But his big news is about the tariffs being looked at unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. That's big news. But he says he couldn't believe Obama brought it up. He didn't really bring it up. He was responding to a question. But you're supposed to say, well, whatever happens, happens. I can't ever tell you. But I think it got John Fetterman's attention, too. John Fetterman weighed in about the idea of aliens and the true story coming out. Cut 54.
That'd be incredible. I mean, this is, you know, I grew up and I was, you know, watching like the X-Files. Now, if he's going to release all the X-Files, I mean, I think that could be a bipartisan thing to finally realize what's happening.
Do you believe there are UFOs and there's alien life outside?
No, I mean, I think what President Obama said, that the odds, because of how many trillions of planets and everything across the universe, I mean, I think life does exist, but the, you know, how it could find us, or how you can explain some of those videos that, you know, that's been released over the couple of years. So for me now, if President Trump is going to release everything, I think that's fantastic, because I think America, I think, and the world would deserve.
Evidently, there's bipartisan support for releasing those records. Can you believe that? Fetterman's not alone among Democrats who said release them. I would love to see some stuff and just put the end. Everything's a conspiracy because people withhold. What happened to RFK? What happened to JFK? What happened with MLK? I don't know. It probably inside job, second shooter. Nobody was alone. How could that guy be able to kill him on the ballot? So what happens is when people don't do a thorough investigation, I know some people will always question. Now, when it comes to aliens, what are they hiding? What do they know? What about that movie? What about this? And now if the president comes out and goes, let me tell you exactly what I know, then you make the most of it. And then have Elon Musk chase him down, come up with some type of device. I think that's a movie that I would sign on to. Don't forget, Sunday at 10 o'clock on One Nation. And don't forget my YouTube channel, Brian Kilmeade.